Good morning. Thank you for coming to Genesis. If you're a guest this morning, we're really glad you're here. I'm wearing my orange hat because, you know, we're doing this series called Harvest. We're kind of talking about, you know, redneck America here. Every farmer and redneck in America is sitting in a deer stand somewhere with a hat just like this on today. In fact, we want to welcome you to National Hunting Widow Awareness Day. I got my John Deere shirt. Nothing runs like a deer, especially this morning. And we're doing this series that deals with issues of harvest, planting, and growing things. It's been fun for me because I've been remembering everything I know about farming I learned from my father-in-law, who farmed 1,500 acres in Illinois. I mean, we're talking flat grain, corn, soybeans, wheat, farm country in Illinois, and he had all the big tractors. He had all the, you know, all the farm equipment, and I didn't know a whole lot until I met him, and then my wife first, obviously, but kind of got to know him and got to ride in tractors with him and riding trucks with him and all these sorts of things, and it's been fun to kind of think about the stuff that I've learned from him and kind of apply it to life. And I hope that if you've been here for a while, that's connected with you, just how we as people in our lives, there is a day of harvest. There is a time in life where the things that we have planted in our lives will eventually grow, and will the fruit or the produce that you put into your life is gonna come out. And at the harvest, it's kind of a time that's too late. And this time of year is, if you drive out through Illinois farm country or you're in places where people have planted crops, this is the time of year where you can drive through and see these giant tractors called combines. These tractors have several different types of, they call them heads on them, that go out in front of the tractor that either spin, or they have this big thing that just cuts corn. And it sucks all the stuff into all the corn or all the wheat or all the soybeans into the tractor, and it starts sorting it out. It's an amazing piece of equipment because what it does is it takes whatever they are harvesting, whether it's ears of corn, whether it is soybeans, whether it is wheat, and it separates it from the rest of the plant. And it will throw all of the crop, all of the grain into a hopper in the back of the tractor. It will throw all the grain into this thing called a hopper, and it will take all the rest of the plant, will grind it up and throw it back out in the field. And so when the farmer gets to his grain bins, all he has is grain. And so I'd never really seen one of these work. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't, but I found a little video this week that kind of showed a combine at work doing its job, and with kind of a funny country song that went with it. I didn't know anybody wrote a song about being a combine driving man, but here it is, all right? Well, there you go. This is the reason that I personally listen to rock and roll. But some of you are like, yeah, keep the music going. All right. Woohoo. Anyway, harvest is a time where, you know, whatever you've grown, it's time to pick it. It's time to use it. It's during the harvest that a farmer starts to see the yield of his crop, to see how successful his year really was, to see how things worked. Found something out this week. I shared last week about the idea of second crop beans and used it as an illustration that in life, there's always a chance to get a new start, a fresh second chance, and that even if the first harvest of our lives was not good, we can have a second crop. I found out from my father-in-law this week that this year in Illinois, second crop beans are having a much higher yield than first crop beans. I just thought, you know, that fits with where we're at. Sometimes in life, if we've made a mess of our lives and we've struggled and we've planted the wrong things in our life, God does give second chances, and sometimes that can be a better crop. But there is a day when the combine shows up, the tractor's in the field, the trucks are there, and they want to get the hoppers filled. And it's at that point in time that farmers really can look at how much grain is coming through the combine and figure out how successful their year was. How did things go? Did the amount of rain and amount of sun in their life produce the crop they wanted? Did they have the right type of seeds? All these sorts of things. And what's going to happen in the text this morning is that Solomon, in the book of Ecclesiastes, is going to help us see, very much like a field has a combine, our lives have a point in time where the harvest happens. And you know, the theme throughout this whole series has been this. The things that we plant, we invest into our lives, eventually do take root and grow. and it is going to show up, and the harvest of life eventually is going to come from the things that we plant in our lives now, as we're young, and young applies to all of us in some way, shape, or form. Book of Ecclesiastes was written to young, especially young men, and it's a challenge from an old, graying, end-of-life dude who has made a mess of his life to these young men to say, listen, invest the right things in your life now, because there is a harvest. There is a point in time where you will not find pleasure in the things that you think matter now. And if you don't invest the right things in your life, when the harvest comes, when the combine runs through the field of our lives, we are going to harvest the things that we planted. And so we need to make sure we're planting the right things. We are investing in the right things. We are putting the right things in our life. And ultimately, for Solomon, his solution is this means that we need to honor and trust God, that he's the only thing in our experience as people on this planet that will give ultimate value, meaning, and life. So if you have a Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I'm going to read a verse. We're going to kind of unpack that, and then we're going to kind of look at the rest and work our way back to the first verse we read. Because chapter 12, verse 1 is the destination. This entire book has been a journey. If you've been with us, if this is your first time with us, let me walk you through the journey. If you've been with us, you'll remember these things. Solomon has taken us on a journey, and the journey is basically the journey to find value, meaning, purpose, and happiness in our lives. Do you want to be happy? Yes. Do you want your life to matter and have purpose and meaning and to make sense? Yes. Do you want that for your kids? I hope so. Solomon has taken us on a journey to try to find that. But basically what he's done is he's led us out through the back roads to show us what paths don't get there. And so Solomon has started by telling us about his life. And he says, listen, I tried it all. I had it all. I tried it all. I was rich beyond your wildest dreams. You can try to get rich. You'll never be as rich as I was. You can try to have power and fame. You will never have power and fame like I did. You can try to have women and relationships. You are not going to top me. I mean, in fact, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 live-in hookers. You're not going to beat that. And Solomon's story is that I have literally tried everything. And my conclusion, Solomon says, is this: it's vain, it's worthless, it's like a breath of wind, a puff of air, it's gone. And Solomon then looks back on his life and realizes that all the things that he lived his life for didn't give meaning, and there's another big problem staring him right in the face, and that is the fact that he is old, and death is a real reality for him. And so, you know, as you read Ecclesiastes, it can be kind of this dark book that you feel like, man, he's just depressed all the time. But it's this reality for him that's staring him right in the face. And he basically starts to say, it is important that we figure out the things that matter and invest in those, and that we find joy in life. And for Solomon, ultimately, it comes to this. This verse is the destination. He has taken us on a journey through his life. He's used philosophy and ideas to help us think about it, but it was all to get us to Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1. In your Bible, that's going to be, at the end of your rows, we have Bibles for you. We would love for you to have a Bible. If you're there, pass those down so that everybody has one. We're going to be on page 474 in those Bibles this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And verse 1. And this is what Solomon says. He says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. He says, remember your creator in the days of your youth, because a day is coming, the day of the harvest is coming, when you will finally say, I can't find pleasure. There's no going back and doing it over. Now, I think Solomon is admitting to us that God does bring forgiveness in the midst of this. His life is the story of that. But for him, forgiveness and reconnection to God is not something he's going to find great joy in. It's just kind of him slipping back into the kingdom of God at the very end of his life. And he's going to walk us through and say, man, this is what the harvest looks like. This is what the combines working through our fields are going to feel like. This is what it's like to get old or die. I mean, that's the options. You know, I remember when I was 39, the night before I turned 40, I was laying in bed going, God, I really don't want to be 40. I really don't want to end up with a 40th birthday. And I literally heard the voice of God whisper in my ear, the alternative is not better either. You know, and I was like, okay, I guess 40 is okay. I mean, if that's the only two options is 40 or die tonight, I'll be 40. We'll be okay with that. Well, Solomon is helping us see there is a point in life where all the things that we've invested and done in our lives are going to come forth. Old age sets in. Those of you who are young, who are, you know, in your teens, maybe 20s, this is going to seem like such a distant reality to you, what Solomon talks about. But I want to tell you, boom, it's here before you know it. It's amazing how fast the stuff that Solomon talks about in this passage starts creeping into your life as he explains what it's like to get old, how the harvest shows up in our lives, what it's like to kind of hit the wall here and reach the end. And what he's been doing this entire book is he has been saying there are big questions and big issues in life. The question of God, the question of meaning, the question of joy. And we need to find the answers to those questions. And we need to pursue our Creator and remember Him passionately and know Him deeply. Because those are the only things, that's all that will give hope in this life. But man, we have so many different ways, so many different things that we pursue. A guy named Peter Kraft wrote a book called Three Philosophies of Life. And in this book, he basically says, he looks at three books of the Bible. One of those is Ecclesiastes. And in the chapter on Ecclesiastes, he says, in our culture, in our world, we've come up with different ways to what he calls hide the elephant. He says the elephant in the room for all of us is the question of value, the question of God, the question of meaning, the question of death. That these are the big elephant in the room and that we need to wrestle with these deep questions. But he says in our culture, in our world, we come up with all kinds of different ways to keep from dealing with the elephant. He names specifically five of them. I just kind of want to share those with you because I think these are very real. These are things that we all tend to do in our lives. The first way to hide an elephant is diversion. He says, you know, one way we can hide an elephant, he says, one mouse can't hide an elephant, but a million mice can. And what we do is we have this elephant that we need to deal with in the room, but we have a million mice, a million things that we let our lives kind of be about and pursuing and just kind of get in the way, and we never deal with the question of meaning and value and purpose and God. Another thing he says is propaganda. And basically what he's saying here is that our culture is really good at throwing words at people who are trying to wrestle with these deep questions. Words like, well, if you really believe that, you're intolerant. If you really believe that, you're small-minded. And as we wrestle with the issue of God and find God in our lives, our culture wants to hide the elephant by calling names and using propaganda and by marginalizing people who really find true value and find truth in their relationship with God. A third way he says is that indifference. This is just the fact that, you know, I can hide the elephant in a room by turning and never looking at it. I mean, I don't know about you, but sometimes this is the way I deal with these questions. For me, late night is kind of one of these weird times because if I'm up late, my mind starts going in directions of thinking about things that I don't really want to deal with. You know, all of a sudden, you're laying in bed and you're like, I'm going to die. You ever do that? I don't know, maybe it's me. I got this weird dark streak. And so my way of dealing with that issue is to turn on Seinfeld and watch it until I fall asleep because then my mind won't ever go there. I'll be laughing at Kramer. And that's kind of how I deal with this thing is this indifference. Just don't turn around and look at it. You can pretend it's not there. And a lot of us, sometimes this is the way we deal with these big questions. If I just never deal with them, I don't have to answer. I don't have to see the elephant. Another way he says is the pursuit of happiness. This is a good one, and we talked about this a lot in the beginning of this series, that I just pursue everything but the elephant. I pursue everything but God trying to divert my attention away. And so I go after, you know, pleasure and money and all these other things. And this is what Solomon, his conclusion is, I pursued all these things, didn't work. But this is the description of the American state of being. In fact, it's even in our founding documents that we have the right to the pursuit of happiness. Amazing thing they didn't say is we have the right to find it, because it is so elusive. And the fifth thing he says is subjectivism, which is kind of a way of dealing with it, saying, listen, truth is really comes down to you. What you believe is what you believe. What I believe is what I believe. And you have your truth. I have my truth. So if you see the elephant, that's fine. But if I don't want to see it, that's my reality. Basically, what he's saying with these five things is that we all have tendencies, ways that we want to hide the elephant in the room. We don't want to deal with these deep, searching questions, because if we really deal with them, they will drive themselves way into our heart, way into our lives, and we will have to ask the question, really, why am I here? What is this world about? How do I make sense of it? And what he says, and basically what the book of Ecclesiastes is, it is the elephant. It is forcing us to deal with these great questions. And what Solomon ultimately is trying to get us to is to say this. Meaning, value is found here. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. Find value and meaning in the one who made you, in the person who created you, and figure that out, because there's a day coming where you're not going to find pleasure in the days anymore. And then he walks through this description of old age, and it's one of the funniest passages. I hope I don't offend you this morning. If you're older, I probably will, and I'm sorry, but it's from the Bible, and I'm just being honest with the text. And if I make fun of, like, your grandma, I don't mean to. I'm just telling you what the text shows us. This is where we're all going. He says the combine shows up in one of two ways. So let's look at this. Look at starting with verse 2, as Solomon describes old age. And realize, he is talking first person. He is explaining his state of existence now and saying, man, I invested all these things in my life. It didn't work. And now I'm old. This is what my life looks like. And so chapter 12, verse 2, he says, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. Now, here's what he's going to do. Next few verses, he's going to describe the existence of people that are aging, people who are getting older. And he's going to use all kinds of images that deal with a household and just kind of living in a home to describe these. And he starts off by saying, listen, the sun and the moon and the lights are darkened and there's clouds. And he's basically talking about your memory and just kind of the way your brain functions, all right? I don't know about you. I'm only 42 years old. I can never find my keys. I can't remember where I put stuff. It drives me crazy. And you get around people who are especially aging, it's, you know, this idea that you just can't recall things that you used to. And Solomon's saying, listen, there's a point in time where, you know, the sure signs of Alzheimer's set in. There's two of them. One is that I can't remember anything, and I can't remember the second one. You know, where we come to the point where it just seems like the lights are dimming, all right? And he says, this is what happens. The second thing he says, verse 3, he says, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. You ever, you know, you run your grandma with a coffee cup and she's got, you know, and the water's just going everywhere because she's got the shakes. He's talking about the fact that your arms and legs, they get this trembling motion. And, you know, he says, I walk around and everywhere I go, I'm just trembling. I get the shakes. I can't stop. The keepers of my house, they used to guard my house, and now they just tremble. They shake. He goes on to say, chapter 12, verse 3, and the strong men are bent. The guy used to be a football player. Now he walks like this with a cane. You know, the strong men are bent. There's a time where you can't do the things you used to, because even you're just kind of bent over. You can't, you know, you got the walk going. He says, chapter 12, verse 3, he says, and the grinders cease because they are few. How do you like that one? What do you think he's talking about there? Come here and let me kiss you, honey. Teeth are gone. The grinders. He says, man, I used to be able to eat steak. Now I got to eat everything through a straw. It's not fun. The grinders are few. He says that the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed. What do you think he's talking about here? Your eyes. He's like, man, I used to look out the windows and everything was beautiful. And I can't see so well anymore. My wife's grandma, God love her, a year ago was still driving. They had not taken her driver's license from her, but she couldn't see. And we were at a table and she had just, all right, you need to understand that, just driven in. And I was standing on one end of the table. I was standing. All right, take a good look at me. She is sitting in a chair at the other end of the table, and she's looking at me, and she said, who is that there? I'm like, all right, for real. How can you not see me? And you're driving. This is not a good combination. She's like, but I know where I'm going. It's no big deal. Wow. I'm like, make sure you let me know when you're going, and I will not be there because I don't want to be in a way you won't see me. You know, our eyesight starts failing. People have a hard time seeing. You know, you see these people. My dad's got them now with these big old fat glasses, and they are no longer for him a, you know, he doesn't care anymore about fashion statements, but he can't read. And he buys these glasses that are like, you know, this thick at Walgreens. It's got like 42 pair in every room. I'll never forget, we were at a church one time where a lady was kind of getting to a point where eyesight, and she couldn't see it. You know, it's the you can't read. You got to get the large print Bible. It's a Bible that's like this big. It's got, you know, like pages this thick, and the print is, you know, huge. And still, it's, you know, like this. This lady had trouble with her eyesight, and she was singing on a Sunday night with a group of, there were three ladies who were singing. It was a trio. And she was sitting in a pew just before she was supposed to go up, and she started searching. And I thought, you know, I was kind of sitting across the aisle. I thought, what is she doing? She is searching frantically. All of a sudden, she pulls a pair of glasses, and you see her take a big, deep sigh. She puts them on and goes up and sings. But what she didn't realize is that her other pair of glasses were sitting on top of her head. So she sang in front of the whole church with a pair of glasses on her eyes and a pair of reading glasses on her head. And I just laughed because it was funny. Our eyesight leaves us, you know. You get old, it's just not fun. You can't see. Verse 4, and the doors of the street are shut. He's probably referring to, more than likely he's referring to hearing. Just, you know, you can't hear so much anymore. And the sound of the grinding is low. And now like this, and one rises up at the sound of a bird. You ever wonder why your grandparents are up at 4:30 in the morning? You know, you go to, when I was a kid, you go to your grandparents' house, you're like, yes, vacation, school is out, I'm sleeping in. And they're banging on the door at 6 o'clock, breakfast is ready. Go to bed. You know, as people get older, all of a sudden they can't sleep so long, their bladder doesn't hold as much. There's just a point in time where it's like, you know, and where is it? It's when the birds start singing. I mean, that first bird, they can't hear anything else, but they can hear that bird when it starts singing, saying, get out of bed. And at the crack of dawn, they are up and they are ready. You know, there's a Seinfeld episode about this. I get so tickled at it, where they're ready to go have dinner at 4 o'clock. Just ate lunch. You know, but, you know, you got to get there early because, you know, we can't have indigestion later. You got to eat early, and we're ready to go to bed at 7:30. This is life as you get older. It becomes the way people exist, that, you know, up early, to bed early, just the way it works. And then you go visit your grandparents, your whole rhythm of life is totally different from theirs. He says verse 4 again, and all the daughters of song are brought low, meaning once again, I can hear the birds, but I can't hear anybody else. Hear the birds singing, it wakes me up, but everybody else is talking. I'm like, honey, I can't hear you. What'd you say? I'm already finding that. I'm losing my hearing. I'm, like I said, in my 40s, and I have to really concentrate. If I'm sitting in a restaurant with a group of people, and there's ambient noise in the background, I have the hardest time hearing people. I'm like, what? 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 Drives me crazy, and drives everybody around me crazy too. Verse 5, They are afraid also of what is high. Meaning, you know, just simply put, they're not going to climb a ladder anymore. You know, they got the shakes and, you know, it's scary to do things that used to be just a normal part of life. It's hard to see, you know, your grandpa who you used to be a manly dude. Now he can't do simple things like climb a ladder because he's afraid to go up. He's afraid what'll happen. And he says also verse 5, he says, afraid also what is high, the terror is in the way. The almond tree blossoms. This is great. You know what an almond tree does in the fall? All of its leaves turn white, and then they let go. Thank you very much. It says, man, there's a point where the almond tree is going to blossom, meaning it's going to turn white or it's going to let go, all right? Some of you are like, oh, I'm already experiencing that. And I really don't like, you know, gray. I don't like, you see, or the alternative to gray. It just is. And so the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along. Think grasshopper, you know, it jumps, you know, you come up grasshopper. And now it's just like, oh, I can't even do it anymore. And the last one, he says, and when desire fails. It's what you think it means. Did anybody else like go in the morning when Mike Ditka did a Viagra commercial? I don't know. That's just me. I was like, no. And then Rafael Palmero was doing it. I mean, actually, this is a reference to an ancient aphrodisiac. And it's saying, you know, it doesn't work anymore. It's when the guy, his honey kind of looks and winks at him. His wife looks and winks at him. And he goes, I'm just going to watch TV. At that point, it's all downhill. It is not fun anymore after that. It's just the way it is, you know. Now, what's he getting at? This is what he's saying. He's describing the aging process, but here's what he's saying. Don't miss this. He's talking to young people, and he's just being gut honest, saying, these days are going to show up. You can't stop them. They happen. And this combine, this time of harvest is going to show up in your life. And life is not going to be fun like it is when you're 22. You're going to have aches and pains. Your eyesight's going to go away. You're not going to have all the drive and desire you used to. Now you're a grasshopper, you know. But someday that grasshopper's not going to want to jump anymore. And life is not going to be just all about fun. And here's the deal. What you invest in your life now is going to be what drives your life then. And he said, also says there's actually another way that the combine shows up, and that's death. I mean, I'll just run through this real quick. He says in chapter 12, verses 6 and 7, he says, or verse 5 at the end of it, he says, the grasshopper drags itself along and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. Just a very clear image that there's a point where you go to your eternal home and people are going to be crying, people are going to be mourning, but you will have gone to your eternal home. He says, before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowls are broken, the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the cistern. Now, I can explain to you, these are images of different parts of your body. But the bottom line is that all of them deal with the gathering of water. And water in ancient culture is an image of life. And what he basically says is there is a point where the ways that your body functions and contains life will be broken. And that will be the end, you know. And verse 7, and dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. There's just this point. The harvest comes. The combine is in the field. What I've planted in my life has come to full fruit, and now it is time to pick that. And it either comes through getting old and just living a long life, but the end of life, the things you've invested in your life come out, and now you don't have the potential to go back and start over and experience the joy that Solomon is calling us to, or, boom, heart attack, you die. Boom, car wreck, you die. Wow, morbid, darkness. But this is what it's the elephant in the room. We have to be honest in our lives about the fact that there is value and meaning and purpose and invest the right things in our lives to find that, to have that harvest in our lives. And so this is why Solomon starts this passage with this. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth. It is a great phrase. Solomon is not saying, oh yeah, remember God. You know, I know you kind of forgot about him, but you know, wake up one morning and go, oh yeah, dude, God, he's there. All right, cool. This is a phrase that's actually packed with depth. In the Hebrew Bible or in the Old Testament, the word remember is a very key word because it is a covenant word. It is a word that deals with God and his dealings with people when God makes promises to his people and people trust and honor God with their lives. And often in the Bible, it uses the term remember when it talks about a person who is far from God turning and coming back to trust God and to give God their entire life. It also is used of God several times when God intervenes on behalf of his people. So like in the story of Noah and the ark, God called this guy to build this boat, and God promised him that he would take care of him, and so this guy built this huge boat, and God flooded the world. Noah and his family were in this boat that was called an ark, and they're on that for, you know, over 100 days, and it just seems like they were out there, and the Bible tells us that one day God remembered Noah. Now, it's not like God went to the casino, was playing blackjack, and then all of a sudden was like, oh yeah, I forgot all about that dude. I need to go back and check out how he's doing, okay? It's not like God forgot. When it says God remembered, what it means is that God is now going to step in and keep his promise. In Exodus chapter 2, the Bible tells us that the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, were in slavery in Israel, or in Egypt. But God had made a promise to them that he would be their God. And the Bible tells us that God remembered his people. It's not that God forgot about them and, oh yeah, I forgot. I was watching the Rams lose again and now I need something better to do, so I remember. No, it's saying that God is now going to step into the lives of his people and make a difference. He's going to bring change. In the Psalms, the Bible talks about, in all these several songs where people are worshiping God, it says that they are remembering God. That remembering, it's not just bringing to mind. It is this point where I say, listen, I am going to have God be the all-consuming passion of my life. I'm going to remember him in that. I'm going to return, give my life, honor him, trust him. And Solomon is saying, listen, nothing else works. Remember your creator. And it's the only time in the entire text of Ecclesiastes he uses this designation for God. In the rest of the book, it's just been God. The Hebrew word is Elohim. But here he uses the title, your creator. And I think what he's wanting to do is he is wanting to take all of us back to the reason we are here. Why are you on this planet? What is the purpose of your existence? And it starts with understanding, I am created by God. I'm not a random accident. I am not a product of evolution. I don't find my value and meaning just from being a good person. I find my value and meaning from knowing that I am created by God. And that he is the central focus of life. And so what Solomon wants us to do, and what I want to do for just a few minutes this morning, is I want to tell you why you're here, why you are on this planet. What is your purpose for existence? And to find this, we have to look in the book of Genesis, the very first book of the Bible, where God created all that is, and he created people. And in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, it says, God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them, and God blessed them, said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. It says that God created man, and he's talking about humanity, Adam and Eve, the first two people, in the image of God. It is affirming for us that God created us and he did it with great care and love. Adam and Eve, the first two people, were the last thing God created. And as you read through the text, the order of creation is that God, everything God creates is leading to the more important aspects of creation. And God, humanity, we are the crown of God's creation. And the Bible tells us we were created in the image of God, meaning that we bear something in our souls that reflects and looks like our creator. And it is that image of God that gives us value and purpose and meaning in life. And so being created in the image of God is a reminder that, I am not my own, that, there is a God who loves me and a God who created me, and I get my purpose and meaning from him. So what does that mean? What does it mean that you are created in the image of God this morning? What does it mean that God formed and fashioned you with a little bit of himself into your life? I just want to share with you what I think that the text, when it talks about being created in the image of God, what it really is getting at, what it really means. And there's three things. And the first thing is this, that God created us to relate to him. That God created you, God created me to have a relationship with our creator. Genesis chapter 1 tells us the story of creation as God lays it out. But Genesis chapter 2 unpacks the creation of humanity, of Adam and Eve, these first two people. And God created Adam and Eve and created them in his image. And one of the cool pictures that goes on in the first couple chapters of the Bible is that Adam and Eve, these first two people, literally are walking with God. And the way the Bible pictures it, in the cool of the day. They are so close to God that it's like taking a walk with him. They are interacting with him on a very personal and real level. And when God created Adam and Eve in the image of God, with his imprint, his stamp in their lives, the first thing it means is that they are able to relate to him. They are able to know God and be known by God. They are able to connect to God and interact with him. They are able to talk to him. They are able to hear from God. They are able to just connect with their creator. And you are on this planet with the image of God. One of the reasons that God put you here is to have a relationship with your creator, to know God, to interface with him, to interact with him, to connect to him, to have a relationship with him. God put Adam and Eve here. They walked in the cool of the day. They lived with him in the midst of their presence, and they honored him with their lives. And the second thing that I think the Bible teaches us that the image of God means is that we were created to represent God, that we were put on this planet as representatives of God's purpose and values on this earth. It shows up in Adam's life like this. God brings all the animals to him, and he allows Adam to name them. What a cool day that would have been. There's a giraffe. There's a donkey. It seems like really weird and mundane. Why would God give the purpose of naming the animals to Adam? But it's so much more than just, you know, dog, cat, platypus. What he's really getting at is Adam names creation. What's gone on is that God has spoken. Every, you know, Genesis chapter 1, God speaks and things come into existence, and God names these things. But what happens in Genesis 2 is that God gives the responsibility of caring and overseeing his creation to the man. And Adam is now on this earth, God's representative in the garden that God has placed him. He's to till it, he's to care for it, he's to oversee it, he's to protect it. He is to be God's representative. And that's one of the reasons God has placed us on this earth, to represent him, to be people who in our lives represent our creator. And the third thing it says is that we were created to reflect God, that we were created literally to bring glory and to live the glory of God. We were to be little mirrors that reflect the glory and the majesty of our creator. And that as we live our lives, God's glory is reflected off of us. And so God creates the first two people, and he created you and me, and we are created with the image of God. But what happens, Genesis chapter 1 tells the story of creation. Chapter 2 tells the story of how these people lived this out. And so they are in perfect relationship with their creator. They're representing him. Because of that, they have this perfect relationship with each other. The first marriage happens in the book of Genesis chapter 2, and Adam and Eve are in this beautiful relationship, and one of the greatest verses in the whole Bible, they were both naked and they were unashamed. It's a cool verse, and men love it. You guys are like, that's awkward. I don't know if I should laugh or not. You can laugh. All right, anyway, it's beautiful because there is this unbroken, glorious relationship as they live out the purpose of God. But what happens is God says, listen, I've given you everything and I want you to enjoy it all. I want you to enjoy everything in my creation. But he sets up one guideline. There's one thing, one tree, don't eat from it. And we get caught up in a tree. But here's what God did. God basically told Adam, I have created you in the image of God, and here's your choice. You can live for the purpose which I created you, or you can spend it all on yourself, your choice. And in chapter 3, Adam and Eve go, God, we don't want a God. We don't want a creator. We want to be the center of our own universe and call our own shots and be our own God. And they do. And what happens is you and I make the same decision every day. To be the center of our own existence, to not live for the glory of the one who created me, but to live for myself. To not represent God, but to live for my values, my meaning, my purpose. To not be a reflection of him, but to reflect my own glory. And instead of being a part actor, a small part in the great drama that is creation and God's purpose, I want to be the star of my own show. And there is brokenness and discontent and hopelessness in the world because this is not why we were created. Adam and Eve fell. All of creation has fallen. You and I fall daily. And the story of the Bible, the message of the gospel is this, that we cannot fix ourselves. But God himself came for us in the person of Jesus and gave his life as the payment for our sins so that we can come back to the purpose for which we were created. This shows up in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, in the first prophecy of the Bible, where in the curse, God is speaking to Satan, the serpent who tempted them. And he said, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He will bruise your head and you will bruise his heel. This is what he's saying. That the text is telling us that the serpent came in, tempted Adam and Eve. They fell. And because of that, that God is going to send the seed of the woman. This is Jesus who is eventually going to come. And while the serpent will strike his heel, while the serpent is going to be involved in the death of Jesus, eventually it is the death of Jesus that will crush the work of Satan. And you and I have hope. You and I have the opportunity to know God again, to relate to him. How? By trusting Jesus. God came for us. You and I can represent God. How? By living our lives for his purpose and values, by trusting him, by living according to the scriptures, by running to Jesus when we fail, by living repentance. You and I can live where our lives become mirrors shining the glory of God. But this is what we want. We want God to be our assistant. We want to order our lives and then tell God, bless it. We want to set up our own values and our own agenda and just say, God, make it work. And what we really want is the same thing Adam and Eve wanted in Genesis chapter 3. We don't want an all-consuming creator who calls us to abandon ourselves and to live for his glory. We want a cosmic assistant who's like a genie in a bottle that I can rub the lamp and get what I want from out of him. And when God doesn't come through on every little thing that I want, I get mad at God and run away. And we want an assistant who will let me set my own purpose and agenda for life. And while I set my own purpose and agenda for life, he will come through when I need him, but it doesn't require anything of me. This was Solomon's approach to spirituality. And what his conclusion is this, remember your creator. We're all young in here compared to his list here. I mean, you may be like me and you're starting to lose a little bit of your hearing, or maybe you get reading glasses, or you got the white hair, or maybe the almond blossom has let go. I don't know. But we all still have a chance to start investing the right things in our life. And the heart of it is that I remember Christ. I remember God. I remember my creator. I stop seeing God as my cosmic assistant. I start seeing him as the all-consuming passion of my life. The end result is that I enjoy earth, but earth is not the reason for my existence. Now, I close with this. It's an illustration by a guy that I really respect named Tim Keller. He's telling the story of how he really came to deep faith in God. And it went like this. He said he was in a service where a lady was speaking, and she said, here's what it's like. He said, the distance between the earth and the sun is 92 million miles, and that if we were to take that distance and compare it to a piece of paper, okay, so this is 92 million miles right here. The distance between the earth and the next closest star will be a stack of paper 70 feet tall. Imagine that. This is 92 million miles. The Earth to the next star is a stack of paper that would be 70 feet tall. And if we were to compare it to the diameter of the galaxy, it would be a stack of paper 310 miles tall. And our galaxy is just a speck of dust in the universe. And the Bible tells us in Isaiah chapter 40 that Jesus measures out the universe in the palm of his hand in a span. And the distance, the image is between his thumb and his pinky finger. And that Christ holds this in his hand. And this is what we do with our lives. We look at that God and say, be my assistant. Let me order my life the way I want to and live for myself. And you just bless it and make it work. We've got things wrong. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. Father's time. Because there's a time when all the things that I live for, it's going to show up. The combine's going to be running. Life's going to be at the end. So my challenge to you this morning, I don't know where you're at. You may be a follower of Jesus and just need to reorient your life to make sure Christ is the all-consuming passion of who you are. You may be exploring faith, just kind of peering over the fence, checking faith out. And I just want to encourage you to look to Jesus and find the beauty of your creator. You're created with meaning and value. You were created to relate to God, to represent God, to reflect his glory, and to live for him. Life will not work apart from your creator. I'm going to pray. We're going to come. The band's going to come out here. We're going to worship. We're going to sing. We're going to celebrate because we look to Jesus, who is the author and the founder of our faith, and he is the perfecter of our faith. And we're going to look to him and celebrate him because he needs to be the all-consuming passion of our lives. We're going to take up an offering. Our offering, if you're a guest, we do not want you to give, expect you to give. We take up an offering in our service because it is an opportunity for those who are a part of our church to give back, just say, you know, God has blessed me, and now I give back to honor him and to worship him. It's an act of worship for us. And we're just going to celebrate who Jesus is. So I'm going to pray, invite you all to stand after that, and we'll sing, all right? Lord, we love you. Praise you for who you are. Just pray that you will speak into our lives this morning and you will challenge us to remember our creator in the days of our youth. Not just to recall to our brain, but to come back to a trust and an honoring of you. Thank you that even as we get older, we can experience the joy of your goodness in our lives. And thank you that we had a chance to be here this morning and hear what your word says to us. Just challenge us now to respond by honoring you and trusting you. In your name I pray. Amen.